In today's episode...
If my mum was going to look how to build a website, she wouldn't type how to build a website with no code, and she wouldn't type how to build a website with code. But if she typed in how to build a website, she should be seeing this is how you do it with card with zero code. This is how you do it with Webflow, a bit more technical. This is how you do it with HTML, CSS, like pick your path type thing. So, I mean, Makepad, we want to be that jumping off of point for people.
Welcome to another episode of Creator Lab. This is your host, Bilal Zaidi. Today's episode is with Ben Tossel, the founder of Makerpad, the leading online community for no-code. His company was recently acquired by Zapier, a $5 billion tech company. Ben is also an educator and investor in the no-code space. In this conversation, you'll learn all about what it was like to get acquired by Zapier, developing the maker muscle by building and launching projects, what it takes to build a paid learning community, and knowing when it's the right time to monetize, the 80-20 of learning no code and the evolution of learning and membership models. Let Ben and I know what you think of this on Twitter. I'm at BZady and he's at Ben Tossel. Links in the show notes below. We'll get straight into the convo with Ben after a brief message from our sponsor. This week's episode is sponsored by Space, the easiest way to engage your team over audio. Space helps remote teams have engaging discussions over audio. You can create rooms that are always open, as well as scheduled or live discussions, so your team can communicate without meeting links and friction. To learn more, book a time with an onboarding expert at joinspace.co. And I also want to thank our sponsor, MicroAcquire, the largest startup acquisition marketplace. If you're looking to sell your SaaS company, get access to more than 50,000 trusted buyers and say goodbye to brokers and huge fees. It's entirely free for founders and private with no middlemen. If you're looking to buy a SaaS company, choose from hundreds of vetted startups. Most deals close in 30 days. Check it out and sign up at microacquire.com. Now let's get straight into the show. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So look, man, I've been following what you've been doing with Makerpad for a little bit of time now. It's been incredibly impressive. You've obviously been acquired by Zapier, rhymes with happier. I just confirmed that with you before this call. So there's a great story in this, but I think for today's conversation, we're really going to be talking about paid communities, paid learning platforms, what you've built. But also the no code movement, because you've been a huge pioneer in that space. But before we even get into all of that, I noticed that you'd spent some time in China, and I haven't really heard you speak much about this. So I'm curious, like, take me back to that time, man. Like, what made you want to go to China, and what was that experience like for you?
Yeah, I didn't think people would be bringing that up ever again. It was in university. I was doing real estate for the first year and like didn't go to any of my classes, and then was like, oh, I've got to actually go and pass some stuff. I want to change my course. I don't really want to be a surveyor necessarily. So I went to my dad and said, I want to do like, I don't know, a business course. So he said, well, pick something a bit more like specific than just business. So I came up with international business, and I was always quite good at languages. So I decided to, you may especially have a language with the course. So I picked Chinese because I've done French and Spanish at school. So I was like, okay, well, that'll make me stand out in a crowd if I have to go and be an investment banker or something in the future. I'll do Mandarin. So as part of the course, I think it was like you do 3 years in the UK and then you do 1 year where you work or study abroad. So obviously I was doing Mandarin, and then I went to university in China for like, it was only like 5 or 6 months. So yeah, went out there, and it was crazy. It was just like a different world. And when I first got there, they sent me to the wrong campus because I was like the first person to go from my university to this Chinese university. I was like the guinea pig. And I was, for some reason, down to learn business taught in English to Chinese students. So I was on like the Chinese campus. I was the only like person not from China there. And I was like, I think I'm in the wrong place. So they had to like fiddle some stuff around, but then I got into like the international campus and made lots of friends from Germany and Holland and places like that. So that was a really good experience. But yeah, that was crazy.
Yeah, I just noticed it last night. I think when I was doing research, I looked at your LinkedIn and saw that, and I just thought it feels like we're doing a job interview right now. But like, tell me about your time in learning Mandarin. But it was just about Like, it takes a certain type of person. And I know lots of people do this in the UK. They go abroad. We have like sandwich courses, we call it. But like a lot of people just do a year in industry, like somewhere locally. But in Europe, I think it's quite common. There's like a thing called Erasmus or something where people go and study abroad, which I think is really cool. But yeah, the reason I brought it up is just it takes a certain type of person who's willing to go into a completely different place, want to go and learn a new language. And I think maybe if you had a business background or interest in business anyway, I'm assuming maybe a part of it was to do with that too, right?
It was all to do with that. I thought, well, if I learn Chinese and I have a business degree, that'll like give me a leg up in the business world, because at the time it was all talk of like China is the big wave that you need to like hold on to and take notice of. So that's sort of where I was positioning myself, so that my dad wouldn't feel like, oh, he's just done business at university and sort of hang around for a few years. So it was like I could come out and say, look, well, I've got that under my belt to use if I ever need it again. But didn't ever need it again, except for these types of stories that I end up mentioning.
Well, not yet. We're in 2021. Maybe in 10 years it'll be useful again. But
I'd have to do a refresher course on that, I think.
Yeah, or we'll have like the Neuralink in us and we just download the language.
Exactly.
Another moment I kind of wanted to zoom into was your acquisition from Zapier, but not literally the price and all that stuff, because I know you can't comment on that.
No.
But let's talk about this DM from Wade, the founder and CEO of Zapier. And from what I could see, someone had tweeted out something along the lines of, I think you had tweeted out, like, on MakerPad, the most popular tools things that are used the most were Airtable, Zapier, and a bunch of others. And someone responded saying that one of these two companies should buy MakerPad. And apparently the CEO of Zapier saw that and was like, yeah, actually, maybe we should have a discussion about that. So take me back to that moment where you're looking in your DMs and you're like, okay, here's a message from someone who runs a $5 billion company. Like, just take me back to that moment, man.
Yeah, I think, that's basically the story. That is that I tweeted out the top 10 tools used by MakerPad users. And then Walter Chen, I've always got I own a number of beers, I'm sure. He tweeted and said Airtable or Zapier should buy MakerPad ASAP. And Wade and I had met before. I'd met him in San Francisco the November before, so November 2019. At NoCodeConf, we had like a dinner organized, like six or seven of us were there. So I'd met him, we got on really well, and then Zapier were a partner of MakerPad. We were doing work with them. So I'd exchanged some emails with him, but I wasn't like close or really friendly with him necessarily. I actually responded to Walter's tweet and said it'd be like picking between my parents. And Wade sent me Walter's tweet and said, did you see this tweet? He's not wrong. Let's have a chat. And I was like, holy shit. Okay, cool. Let's I've got to play this game and act cool and like, yeah, okay, let's talk and see what you're thinking. So that's how it all actually started. So
And again, I know you can't comment on price. The closest I can do is paint a picture for the people listening, because obviously everyone's wondering that. So I know you had mentioned previously revenue was up to like 400K a year. That it may have been more or less since then. And I think you'd also raise money. And I'll just reference a guesstimate that Cortland Allen from Indie Hackers had mentioned in your conversation. He said he thinks that you had raised enough money to be valued at least $1 million. So you probably made an offer, a multiple of that. So potentially in the single digit millions. Regardless, I know, you know, for legal reasons, you're not allowed to talk about that, which is completely cool. But I'm curious, as someone who's the founder of something, who's put their life and soul into something, and you're getting this, you're having this conversation, you just mentioned there, like keeping it cool, right? Like what goes through your head in terms of knowing what the right price is and what you're willing to kind of take? Like, I'm assuming it's not just the first offer, you know, is the right offer. There's a negotiation that happens. So I'm just curious, like what you are able to share. How's that process even look like for someone who's being acquired?
Yeah, I think it's like, I still see it through how I was looking at other people being acquired and being like, oh, I wonder what that process was like. And I'd listen to a bunch of podcasts on it and hear people talk about it. I'm like, oh, why can't they share the price? Why can't they tell us this, that? And yeah, and then I'm now that annoying person in exactly the same situation, which, yeah, legal reasons just means you can't do it, basically. But for me, literally, after we had that call, and like, I think it's too late now for me to pretend like I was acting cool then, is I just did what I assume a lot of other people would do, is, okay, let's get a spreadsheet, let's put the numbers in and see like what seems like a really good outcome for us. So I did that basically until I had a call with Wade, and then until we had an actual offer from them, I was just sort of looking in my spreadsheet and thinking, oh, cool. So if it was in this sort of range, I'd be really happy. If it was this range, it would have to be like a certain type of deal. And then I don't think it's going to be anything above that. And yeah, I was like pretty taken back by when Wade came back with an offer, and I was like that's a really good offer for us. It wasn't necessarily what I was eyeing up on my spreadsheet either. So I was like, okay, that's like a great offer for us. And I think it wasn't just, it's never just the number, because I think obviously lots of things happen where there's like, you end up in a more of a partnership than here's a load of money, we'll have your company now and you go do whatever. Like, it's not like that. It's like, okay, is Zapier the right home for us? Is that like, what can we do with them? What do they want us for? What do we want to go to them for? Like, all of those things actually take a big part of like, what is worth it for you to get acquired by a company. So there's lots of those things to go through. And I know that that's not like the cool way to talk about an acquisition. It's not necessarily just like the numbers. And I know that that's what lots of people want to talk about, but realistically, that is what it is. You sort of go through this dating process of, oh, okay, so how do you think about the world? This is how I think about the world. This is what we think we can do in the future. This is what we think. And you sort of go through those stages and, yeah, you figure out stuff that way. And yeah, Cortland on his podcast was trying to like, he did a video, I think, and he was trying to get my reaction when he was like guessing numbers and things, but I don't think I gave anything away, luckily. So
that's cool, man. Yeah, completely. And and I think what's interesting, because Cortland's also gone, he went through a very similar process with Indie Hackers getting acquired by Stripe. It's probably the closest comparable in a way, because they're both communities. I think yours is slightly different because you had a paid component from, I don't know if it was from day one, but you had a significant paid part of it. And yeah, so anyway, I don't care that much about the money. It's more just interesting to hear the process.
Yeah, cool.
And I think I like the way you described it there, like a dating process, because it's the same whether you're getting acquired, if you're getting investors, I'm sure it's a similar process. You're making sure it's the right type of investor who's not going to be nagging you, taking you in a different direction. Or like, I've had people on the show who've told me they've had an $80 million offer on the table and one of the investors like vetoed it and then they made zero. So like, those sort of things happen too. And that's, so that's a whole different conversation. So thanks for sharing that. I also want to talk a little bit about before MakerPad. So I've heard you mention you tried setting up an app store for bots with another guy who, I think it was Mubs, right? Who's also been on the show.
Yeah, Mubs and another guy, Seth. I think he still runs it. Seth still runs it himself now.
Oh, cool. Yeah, so and I haven't heard you talk too much about other stuff that you've tried before MakerPad, but maybe was that the only one, or were there some other things that you tried out that didn't necessarily work out the way you wanted?
Yeah, there's probably hundreds, and it probably tells that you haven't heard of any of them, because none of them worked. I was just that person that, like, that's how I got into no-code in the first place, was, like, I went to university and was doing this business thing and thinking, one day I'll be an entrepreneur, I'll be in business somewhere, somehow, doing something. So I spent a lot of time, like, how can I build stuff, or how do I get an idea out there? And a lot of it was, you've got to go and learn to code, or you've got to find someone technical to build your ideas. And I was like, oh, it just didn't feel like that's the only option. It doesn't feel like that should be the option. But at the time, you hear all of the Silicon Valley stories of Airbnb or whatever it was that raised a bunch of money, had technical people building stuff. And you're like, okay, well, it makes sense. And that seems to be the story. And I just realized that I just had to be like as helpful as possible, somehow force my way into lucky situations with other people who can build something, and maybe someone will build something for me one day. And Mubs was the person that I managed, I guess, to convince, the first person to build something with me. And we launched that on Product Hunt. It was called Marketing Stack. And that was just like a directory of different marketing things. So email newsletter software or social media scheduling tools and things like that, basically. And that was like the first of me getting that maker bug and wanting to just like, okay, well, now I want to try a different type of thing. I want to do other things. And then I was not wanting to rely on like having to ask someone or try and pay someone to build something for me. I was like, I want to move the buttons myself. I want to change the colors myself. I want to just like do that thing. So while I was at Product Hunt, tools like Typeform, Zapier, Webflow, Bubble, they were all doing launches like through me or via Product Hunt. And I was seeing them and just thought, I think I can string a few of these together and make them like work and feel like a real product. So that's what I just started doing. And yeah, I mean, the maker bug really just took me from there. Like, I must have had 50 plus things that I'd launched. And they were all along the lines of like startups helping startups. Like, you know, you get the like that obvious thing. What's the first market I could go after? Oh, I'm interested in startups. How can I help other startups? And you just sort of think that's an easy way to get some wins. But yeah, there's plenty of things that didn't work. I tried launching like an MVP in a box type service. So I built basically what I was building. There was landing page, a Typeform backend, Airtable, Zapier in the middle. And I would like set that up for someone for $300. But yeah, no one paid for any of them. So
yeah, it was just, that's interesting.
That's, I think, well, that's how like the no code stuff came around. It was like, well, people don't want to just have it done for them. They want to learn how to do that. So that's where the whole education piece came into it.
Got it. Yeah, no, I love to hear that because, again, it's kind of cliche to say by now that like it's not an overnight success. It's taken many, many years and many, many projects that went to zero. But I think it's also important for people to hear like you probably did create 50 different things. And it doesn't mean everyone has to go and create 50 different things, but it took a lot of experimentation and building the skills to eventually land on something that seemed to work. So a question I have though on that is, a lot of people I know, especially kind of in the indie hacker community, I find, and I love the indie hacker community, but people who are like creating stuff, a lot of the time you can just get like stuck into the tools and be like, oh, this is so cool, I can create something, which the part of that is amazing, but the other part of it can be really distracting. And you can actually like just create something that looks cool or feels cool, but doesn't actually have a market for it. And when I had an interview with Cortland Allen from Indie Hackers, that whole conversation was his kind of framework for actually building a business, not just a product. So I'm curious, like when you were going through this, how did you know which project to stop doing and move on from and the ones that you ended up kind of sticking with? Because there's always that feeling of, I don't want to really let this go. I see potential in it. So did you have like some set of criteria to realize this is the right time to move on from it?
Not particularly. And I think this is like part of the same interest as like indie hackers and no code and all of that sort of sits together in this same space where, because you're building with no code and you can build things so quickly, your emotional attachment to something is probably a lot less than if you spent 9 months learning to code to build that thing. So you can easily throw it away if it doesn't work. And I think for me, the thing I only knew something was working with when it was like people were paying for it every day, every week, every month without me really having to do much. I wasn't like pushing it onto people. People were pulling it from me. So that for me felt like a, this is working. Like, I think it's very obvious for people when things are working, and it's very hard to tell when things aren't working. So I would always think, charge something, and if people are paying for it, that's when you can start to tell, like that's the early signs of, okay, there is something here. It may not be your big idea, the big thing that you want to launch and run in the future, but there is something worth exploring there. And I think this is what lots of people do, where they'll have an idea for something and think, right, okay, my big idea is going to be Airbnb for dog homes, for example. And then they'll either procrastinate and not build that thing, or like Google every how to like get your first customers, listen to every podcast on it, and do all that stuff that is procrastinating rather than actually doing the thing, because they don't want the thing to fail, which is understandable. But I think if someone's in that position of, I want to launch something, but it needs to be like the perfect thing, I need to have all the tools lined up exactly the right way, I think that's the wrong way of thinking about it. And I would love to have said, this is the first thing I ever built was MakerPad, and it worked. I didn't want to have to ever come back and say, I built like 50 things, 100 things, but that is the reality. So if someone's thinking, I've got this one really great idea that I think will work, but I need time to explore it and all that stuff, I would just say, well, we'll build all those little things, the stupid things, the silly things with your friends, build those things just to get that muscle of building something, letting it go and it not working, like having that, those repetitions of saying, okay, well, I did build 50 things, but the intention there was to learn how to use the tools or how to just go through the process of building something, getting out there and getting a few email addresses. Like, if that's the thing that's stopping you, then there's other avenues to do that. And I think no code really opens up that whole piece for people. So it's okay to just build stuff for fun or to learn it. Like, that's reasonable. I didn't think that way when I was at Product Hunt either. I thought everything had to be a serious business. Is this going to be a business, like a $1 billion company? Like, no, why have you got another weather app? Like, there's no point of that. It's just, but that's not the motivation for most of the people. And I think that is fine.
Yeah, that's a good point, man. There's obviously no one right way of doing things as well. But I think the commonality I've seen across all the sort of people I've interviewed, from indie hackers to billionaires, is like they're not necessarily scared to just try something out and just let it fail. And not to get too deep and turn it into a therapy session, but a lot of that comes from fear, like you said. It's the fear of looking stupid to your friends. It's the fear [S2] Yeah. [S1] Of not being able to, like, honestly, even having a podcast, you've done this yourself. When you put out your first podcast and you get 12 people listening, and or you put a YouTube video out and it gets 7 views, like, that's a weird feeling to navigate. And some of the things I did as a kid, I didn't have that feeling at all because I was 16 and like no one I knew was doing that stuff. So I would I'd be like anonymous on the internet. Whereas now, like for me, I'm like, I have more friends who work in the space. They're like watching what I do. And there's this thing when you leave, like I used to work at Google for a long time. So when I left there, there was an expectation like, oh, what's Bilal going to do? I left and I wrote this epic email and everyone's like, oh wow, Bilal's going to go do this thing. And you do feel a little bit of pressure, to be honest, you know? And I think that's something that you have to navigate mentally, which is, okay, cool. Well, it's okay for me to try something. It doesn't work out. There's always going to be people who say stuff that nag it in your ear as well. So it's just being able to tune that out.
I would never listen back to my own podcast. So and I don't know whether this is like a theme that I'm just noticing now, where one of my first tutorial videos, I did the Product Hunt launch of it, and someone said to me, they were like, oh, I love this idea, but the speaker is like, is dreadfully dull. That was a comment. It was like, it's dreadfully dull. And I was like, wow, okay. I'm trying to launch a tutorial business, and that's like one of my first pieces of feedback.
That's tough.
But then I think it's just, I know it is tough, and I know that some people it's like a lot tougher on others than it is to some people. But I think it's how much space you can put between you and that thing. So if, okay, one tutorial video was bad, or someone felt that way, does everyone feel that way? Probably not. If lots of people do, you can just have someone else do the videos. Or like, by the time you've launched 20, 30 videos, you don't look back on the first one and think, oh, that one got 7 views. It's like, okay, you just got to sort of keep doing the reps. And I think for all of the things that I built, it's the same sort of thing. It's like, you've got to do the reps. And I think someone says this, I think it's Dave Perrell that says about the CrossFit analogy of like, you can't expect to go to a CrossFit class and come out of it like all jacked and muscly. You've got to put in the reps. So you've got to go to that session, then you've got to go to 3 more that week, and then the next week you've got to go to another 4 sessions, and you've got to keep doing that. Otherwise you won't get to the place where you're looking to go, because it's never like a one-hit swing, is it? So yeah, definitely. I think it's just the fear of that, and you've got to do it. It's annoying to hear, though. I know, like, I always think this when I'm doing podcasts. I'm like, oh, I've heard people say, oh, you just got to like build things or just like do it. And I'm like, oh, just shut up. Just tell me actually what you did. But then when you get to that position, you're like, oh, no, that is actually what I did. So I can't really.
There's a reason everyone says it. Yeah. Yeah. I got you.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, and another point I'd add there is you mentioned your dad a couple of times earlier. If you don't, again, not to continue the theme of turning this into a therapy session, but you mentioned, what is my dad going to say? Like, I have to go back to my dad and say, I'm going to do this course. And you were looking for his approval, obviously, right? Like all of us, to a certain extent. I'm curious, like for you, like without getting too personal or as personal as you want to go, like, what was it about your dad specifically? Because is it just like, was he fairly successful in his own world and you wanted to live up to that standard? Or was it just his presence as a dad? Because I don't hear that from everyone, but it was one of the first things you mentioned.
Yeah, so I think he did the very opposite thing to me, where he went when he was like 15, 16 and left school, went to work in like the steelworks and had like a tough time there for literally like a few weeks, decided, no, it's not what I want to do. Went back to school, did his exams, went to law school, worked at a law firm, and then worked his way up in that law firm ever since. And then was managing, running the whole law firm. And that's what he does now. So he's like just been in one job and done that whole thing, but then got to a place of like, okay, he runs a business now. So he's actually like a businessman in that sense. So I always just thought like, oh, I want to do something. It's definitely not law. I definitely don't want to work like the same thing that he was doing. And he said he wouldn't want that for me anyway. So it was just like a sense of we had a nice life and I wanted that and more. Like I had friends and stuff who also had more things. And I don't know if it's like a shallow thing to be thinking, but I think it helped drive, okay, no, I want to like run a business. I want to earn money. I want to do well for myself and I want to provide a nice like living for my family and everyone close to me. I think that's completely fair to say. And there was one thing that was, he had a list when he was younger that was like, right, how do I afford this dream car of mine or whatever? And it was like, go to law school, become a lawyer, blah, blah, blah. Like he had a little list. So we made one before university that was like how to buy Spike. And Spike was this like super yacht that was in this, where my parents have a place in Mallorca. So it was like just this amazing yacht. And I was like, right, what things do I need to do? So it was like learn Chinese, be an investment banker, like earn 100 grand a year, stuff like that. And it was like way off. But he sent me, after the acquisition, he sent me like a note, a handwritten note to be like, you could buy Spark now. Not to say that you should, this is probably a terrible, terrible waste of all your money, but like, it's just, that's the position. We talked about that a long time ago and it's, yeah, it meant a lot to like have that frame of reference and think that way.
Man, that must feel so good. Not necessarily, and I haven't had the same acquisition sale as you, but even on my own small little scale, when I hit certain milestones of net worth or salary, in fact, like I remember specifically, I'll share one story. When I was 16, people listening to this know I had a small e-commerce store and all I wanted to do was get to £1,000 in my bank account, right? And then it was like, can I get to 10,000 and keep going from there? And I remember getting to £1,000 and being like, this is more money than I've ever seen in my bank account, right? And I remember saying to my parents, when I get to this threshold, I'm going to like take them out or whatever. And just that feeling to be able to go and do that is such an incredible feeling. Like maybe the best feeling I've had financially than anything else, like any other big milestone since then. And it's not about money necessarily. It's about what it represents. It's the fact you had this idea, this dream of doing something. And of course, for some people, it really is. They really want the yacht. I think that can actually help motivate people. Zoom in back to Zapier really quickly. I'm curious now with MakerPad, we're going to do a deep dive into MakerPad and how it grew and stuff in a second. But being at Zapier now, I'm curious, like, what was it like? You've agreed to go there, and then now you've been working there for a little bit of time. You've now got a boss, technically, even though maybe you're kind of working independently. What was it like going in before? Like, what were your expectations like going in before versus what it's actually been like? so far in your time there?
Wade and I spoke about this before, and we basically said we're going to leave MakerPad alone and you just carry on running things as you are. So that was sort of my expectation, and that's basically been what it's been like. It's not been, okay, right, we need to change all this stuff and do this differently and try this instead. So for me, it's been like as I expected, except I have Wade as like my CEO coach every week, which I never had before. And I think a big part of my journey as a CEO in quotes is like always second guessing yourself, always thinking, am I doing this right? Like, what would another CEO who's actually done this right tell me to do? Or how should I be thinking about this? And again, it's that same, it's probably the same like niggling thing in your head of, if I launch something, it's going to fail type stuff. It's the same thing as like that. I don't think it ever goes away. It just changes the form that it's shown. So the whole time running MakerPad, I was thinking, we've got to nail a business model. Like, how do we really rely on income coming in and revenue? And how do we get people paid? And how do we make sure we grow the community? And how do we do this? How do we do that? There's all of that stuff. So when I raised money from Earnest Capital, a large reason for that was like, you're essentially in a cohort of other founders in the same position as you. Some are ahead, some are behind, but everyone's just like on a call, which is like a little therapy session for entrepreneurs being like, okay, I'm trying to figure out pricing. Does anyone know what to do about pricing? And everyone sort of goes, oh, I made up mine. I just decided a number and then I increased it until people stopped paying. Someone else will say, this is what I did. And it's just like a nice little session to talk about, oh, not everyone doesn't know what they're doing necessarily, but people are just here figuring it out. And then, yeah, now having been acquired by Zapier, I know that like Zapier is a very successful company so far, has been like, they've done a lot of things differently. And I think MakerPad and no code is different. And I like that. And that's why I think we get on well. And just to be able to say to Wade every week, oh, this is the sort of stuff I'm thinking through and how do you see it and whatever. And it's not necessarily he says, this is what you should do, because it's rarely, if ever, been that so far. It's been, well, how do you think about this? What's making you think this way versus that way? And then we just like have an open discussion. And often it's like asking the same question back to you is the way that you figure out, oh, that's the thing you wanted to do anyway. So yeah, do that. It's like, it's one of those things, you almost need someone else to just say it or ask you that question back to you that then makes you figure out, okay, I think I had a gut feeling that's what I wanted to do. I just sort of wanted someone else to sort of give me the backing to go and do that. But again, it's just minimizing that fear of, if I do this myself, this is all on me, rather than, okay, I've sort of talked it out with a few people. No one seems to think this is crazy. Like that's more reasonable to do now.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, just, it's pretty incredible to have someone like him who's, you know, he I don't think Zapier really even raised that much money, right? So he's grown to $5 billion company is last number I read. And I also realize a lot of people, if you haven't heard of Zapier, it's essentially like the connective tissue between all these tools. So we've been talking about Airtable and Coda and all these other platforms that kind of allow you to do stuff. Like Zapier allows you to connect all of them together, right? So I think of it as like APIs without having to know how to do any sort of coding. Is that like an accurate description of it?
Yeah, I think so. I think like it's automating workflows. So if you have an email come through with an attachment, you automatically have that attachment save in a Dropbox folder or something like that. Something so small and simple can happen, but also really complex workflows that whole businesses run on. So there's, when we were talking to them, we were saying that like Zapier is the connective tissue between the tools, and we're the connective tissue between the community and the people who are like learning and building on these tools.
That's also, yeah, that makes so much sense for them to have acquired you for that reason. Last question on Wade before we move on. Is there anything that surprised you so far working with Zapier? Because I know you're working independently, but I'm sure you've been, like, you're wearing the hoodie today. I'm sure you feel part of the wider community there. Yeah, I'm curious, like, has anything surprised you since you've been there?
Wade especially is how he comes across on anything else that you listen or see or read about him. I think he comes across as quite, like, laid back and happy and just, like, sort of confident in what he's doing. And that's what it's felt like to me. I think my tendency is to run around like a headless chicken sometimes and be, like, a bit erratic and a bit thinking too many things. And I think just seeing, like, well, my company did, like, 400K in revenue in 1 year and Zapier's doing, like, 100 million plus or whatever. I'm like, it's so interesting to just look at other CEOs and think, wow, I wonder how, like, how you're managing your company and how does that look and how does your day actually, like, go and how do those things happen? So it's just like I get one of those a Slack message away that I can ping about these things, which is an awesome thing. But I wonder how, like, how well it'll translate to, like, we're still in our very early days, I think. So it'll be interesting.
Yeah, for sure. Well, that's like the best executive coach you can have. I speak to a lot of people who are paying for someone, which I think is actually great for a lot of them. Like they get a lot of value out of that, but you're not having to pay, you're being paid. So it works even better in that way. So look, let's transition into the paid learning communities part of this and no code. I think you're one of the best examples of this category, and it's kind of an emerging category, I'd say, in the last... I think there's been paid communities forever, even offline, but, like, online specifically, you've been one of the best examples of something like this. Before we do that, can we just quickly define and place people where no code is? What is no code and how it fits into this wider ecosystem?
Yeah, so no code is essentially a visual way to build software. So, like, you don't have to go and write a line of code to be able to do something like build a membership site, build a website, or automate workflows like we just talked about. I think there's many ways to describe it. And I think lots of conversations are around you should pick no code versus code or vice versa. But to me, they're both on the same spectrum. That spectrum is software development. I think on the first rung of that ladder, it's no code, which is very visual. You can sort of think of it as like Lego blocks. You drag things here, you click things, move a button, change the color, that sort of stuff without typing in functions and things like that. But then the other end of that spectrum is pure like writing lines of code to give an output. So it's just no code is an abstraction of that code itself. There is code produced on the back end when you're doing this no code stuff. And it just makes it way more accessible for way more people to like go down that road and start thinking about, I like building software, I like building websites. And then lots of them I'm sure will graduate into, I want to build software like professionally. I want to be a coder. I want to do that job. So I think we're all on the same team, and I just keep on having to remind people that.
Yeah, completely, man. Well, I think maybe we can share a few examples. And actually, this is even a clarifying question for me. So I've been using WordPress for 10, 15 years, and like Shopify has been around forever. Do those tools count as no-code tools? Because I don't necessarily think of them in the same way we think of like an Airtable or, you know, the ones we just talked about. But to me, like as a kid who didn't really know how to really code, like I could play around with it, I would like download WordPress or back in the day, OS Commerce, which was the open source version of like Shopify essentially, and upload it onto a server, and then I would like move things around, but it wasn't as like you couldn't do as much. So I'm curious, like do they even count, or is there a distinguishing point there?
No, I think they definitely count, and I think that's why some people are saying like, oh, no code's been around forever. It's like, yeah, okay, it has. Like, it just the capabilities weren't as like well advanced as they are now. There's many more tools, like the computational power is so much more. There's lots more that you can do. There's bigger things you can build. And I think it's having the different pieces that you can pull together now with Shopify and WordPress and even Squarespace. It was like, if you build something with those tools, you stay in that tool, and that's the only tool you sort of use. But this whole no code movement that's been around for the last couple of years has seen like, okay, not everyone likes using everything on Shopify. They might want to have email marketing with ConvertKit or MailChimp. They want to have a database of people also in Google Sheets or Airtable. So it gives a bit of flexibility to those types of things as well. But I think they definitely count, they should.
Yeah, for sure. All right, well, that's helpful for people who haven't really been exposed to the space. I'm curious, from your community, could you share a little bit about like the size of the community? I know we talked about the revenue previously, but like, what does your community look like in terms of size? And maybe you've even got a few examples of success stories that have come out of MakerPad.
Yeah, so we just recently hit 10,000 members. I think we were like 2,500 members in October last year, 2020. So it's grown a lot in the last few months. And I think, no-code is just growing a lot recently. So it's all power to like the movement. And I know we're pushing a lot of that as well. And it's made up of all sorts of people. Like at one point we had 25% of our users were developers. So it was like developers don't want to write the same code for the same thing over and over again either. They want to see what else is out there, what services they can use. And then they can focus on the more specialist, like complicated bits of that. We have lots of people who are like makers, want to build their own thing. And I think that's even getting pushed even further from like the creator economy, passion economy stuff, alternative funding, like Earnest. I think there's like a big convergence of passion economy, alternative funding, no code, and like indie hackers. All of those like feed off each other. And I think we're just going to see lots more of these like individual creators have a business. Like Lee Jin is one who she's got a course on Maven. She's got her newsletter on Substack. She's got her fund that has like a Notion page. And then this other like on AngelList or whatever it is. There's like a one person band, but behind it, there's lots of tools that I would class as no code tools that can be all part of the same sort of piece. And I think we'll see lots more people like that. But one story from our community is Tessa Thomas, who I use her often, but it's my favorite story. So she joined early in the MakerPad story, and I saw her sort of dabble in a few tools, play around with Zapier, play around with Webflow, and do a bunch of different things and try things out, asking stuff in Slack and our forum, and just trying to figure things out and taking a bunch of tutorials. And then she recently found a product that works, and she's in the fitness space, and she built a way for gyms to like manage all of their automations themselves. So they can have a bunch of automations for new members and existing members and things like that. So she built that. It started doing really well. She then got funding from Earnest Capital as well. And now she's full-time on doing that thing. And she still like doesn't write a line of code. She built everything with no code, but got funding, has a team, and she's like full-time on it now. So, and also we have like this creator program where people come in and create tutorials or different types of content for MakerPad. And she now does that as well. So she's almost like come full circle around to be like, I learned it, I built it, I run it, and now I teach it. So it's a really nice story I like.
That's awesome, man. Yeah, I love that. Yeah, I love the stories of like people just trying to figure stuff out, and then they finally land on something that's actually getting traction, and the fact she's made it a full-time thing. Because I think similar to the indie hackers community, a lot of people are starting something on the side. They want to kind of optimize for freedom, as Cortland had described it. And again, this isn't a no code versus custom code or a individual creator versus a big VC-backed company debate. Like both of them can exist in this spectrum. But the fact that now we're in a stage in 2021 where the leverage you get as an individual is so much greater than it was, say, 5 years ago. And I think these tools definitely help. And not just the tools, because the tools help, but you need the community. You need the MakerPad or the indie hackers to help you figure it out and to have humans who can teach you stuff as well. So I think it all works together. So thanks for sharing context on that, man. Like, let's talk a little bit about like paid learning communities. I've heard you describe MakerPad as learning communities. Is that still the right phrase to use, or has that evolved?
That's how Yeah, that's how we talk about it. Because I literally tweeted this before we came on. And I've seen it happen a few times where there's like, I always hated the word course, or hated like what courses felt like. Because it was usually one person, oh, I'm going to sell you this dream. And then there's like this huge landing page with so much text. And it's like the whole ClickFunnels type stuff. And I was like, oh, it just feels like, feels dirty or something. I don't know. It feels like a bit sleazy. So I always hated the word course. And then what I tweeted about before was like, can the membership model and like education, do they work together? And I just don't know. Like, I'm still working through this answer, and I don't know if there is one, because we see things like Codecademy, where everything, or Masterclass, where things are sort of a reasonable price. It's not like really expensive. It's, I think Masterclass is like $180 a year. And you have access to all of these different classes, and more classes get added. You can take them all in your own time. There's like a forum that supports people to talk about like Gordon Ramsay's masterclass, and you can talk about that there. So that all seems like, I think that works. Like, you pay a membership, you get access, learn on your own time, do whatever you want. But then there's this other flip side where all of these cohort-based courses are coming out now, and it's like 12 weeks to learn to do X with 100 other people. You do all these sessions, and then you almost like graduate with a bunch of outcomes. But then I've seen recently there was one, Reforge, which traditionally did the cohort based. Then they're quite expensive, but they're very like geared towards professionals. So it's like $3,000 to learn the growth program or something, taught by like really like top name people in the growth space. And then they've just pivoted their model to be a membership model, which is like $2,000 for a year. You get access to one cohort, but access to all the rest of the content for the other cohorts. And I think I've read another company, which I can't mention, that does traditional courses, like sells them one by one, and now does like course bundles, but they're now looking at like a membership model. So it got me thinking of like, when does the membership model make sense and when does it not make sense? I think, and the only thing I can think of is membership only makes sense when it's like a self-serve thing. If it's like a live class, I don't see why someone would pay like a yearly fee to have like 12 weeks of like live stuff. And then like the next year, unless they do a cohort every year, I don't know. It feels strange. And I think some of that was in my early thinking of MakerPad, where I was like, well, we're just putting up more and more courses, like more courses, essentially tutorials in a sequence that meant they're like a course, essentially. So part of it was, if you want to learn like consistently and you're going to do that yearly, here's a yearly price. But actually, I think you're better off paying a lot, like a bigger sum of money that helps MakerPad grow. You're supporting the community, and it's like a lifetime like price. So you pay the lifetime fee, and then you get access. You learn whenever you want. You're not on like your own timeline. So it's just an interesting like space that I don't know. Lots of people are doing lots of different things. I don't know what's right or what works or what doesn't, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess it's maybe like you said before, there's probably room for a little bit of both, because there isn't like one way of doing it. But and I like the way you described that there. And I had Gagan Biani on the show, who started Maven, now called Maven at the time, it was unnamed. And he also started, what was it, Udemy before that. So the way I kind of see it is, we went from this world of only in-person teaching, where we pay a bunch of money to universities, whatever. Like, we don't have enough time to talk about that today, but that's what we traditionally did in classrooms. Then we went to like these MOOCs, or like massive online courses or whatever. And you could just pay like $10, $12, $20 or something and do like an Excel course online. And then I think that was incredible. And in fact, there was a lot of free stuff on YouTube as well. But I think the problem with that stuff was 95% of people don't finish the course because there's no accountability. Yeah. And I the best parallel I think of is something I've struggled with, which is exercising regularly, because we all know like how to get a six pack is consume less calories, burn more calories, work out 4 or 5 days a week, lift weights, whatever. So we know, we all know the knowledge most of the time. Actually doing it requires accountability. So for me, recently in the last month, I've started working with a trainer, and I've worked out consistently for the last month for the first time in a whole year since this mess started. And I think I'm literally paying just to have someone else on the phone to be like, oh, you're scheduled for this, like, good luck, whatever, give me some feedback. But really, I'm paying for someone to be on the end of the phone. And like, a community does that in terms of like, oh, we can help each other. And you've even got stuff in MakerPad where people share progress and stuff like that. But I think the cool thing with the cohort-based courses is, okay, you kind of like time block it. You know you're going to turn up. Yeah. You have to be there. And it kind of works in a way. And I think the difference is we've adapted for the pros of the internet, which is you don't have to be in California to go to Stanford. You can like learn similar sort of content through a group online. So that's exciting. But you're right. Like, maybe there is this hybrid model, which is a part on demand and a part community, or like where you do attend a live course. I think that's probably a good mix.
Yeah, I think there's probably something there. And I think Sashir from Coda talked about the myths of bundling and unbundling. This talks about like super fans and casual fans. So like, super fans would pay individually for everything, but casual fans probably need like a group deal to get into something before they can become super fans. I don't know if I'm butchering his writing a bit there, but that's sort of what I've taken from it. But yeah, I think it's just funny. I don't know whether like, if you're paying a subscription, I just don't know whether it's like startup models are coming to education, but not for the right reasons. It's like, okay, we've got this subscription and this many people are paying and this many people don't drop off. Like, we've got this really good recurring revenue model. To me, a recurring revenue needs to be a service or product that you rely on, like you rely on to do. So Slack, I need it to talk to all my team and all of like friends or whatever else. Like, I rely on that. Spotify, I rely on that to give me music and everything else. Netflix, I need that to binge all the shows. Where Masterclass, I think, is interesting is that's more like the edutainment. It's education, but it's entertaining. So actually, you would sit down and watch something on Serena Williams playing tennis because it's like, it's interesting to know. It's not necessarily you're learning to play tennis from Serena Williams and you're going to go away then and then be a tennis player, but it's an entertaining watch that you might watch something similar, slightly adapted on TV. So it makes me think like, are the pieces aligned there where it's saying, well, this is a model that works and this is the experience we're trying to give. Let's just like mash the two. I wonder. Cause I think like you said, lots of it is like, well, I just want someone to like be disappointed if I don't show up to this thing or do this thing. Like, a part of the cohort stuff is definitely to do with like having a peer group around you.
Yeah, completely, man. Well, I think the edutainment or the masterclass example is an interesting one because, or I'd actually put like Netflix in a similar, like adjacent to that, because Netflix, the reason we keep paying $10, $20 a month or whatever it is because they keep bringing on stuff that keeps us there. And that's why they'll stagger out series drops and they'll like tease you with the next one and they'll keep buying new rights to stuff. And I think similar for Masterclass, I don't know their numbers, but I think a lot of people sign up because they're like, oh, I want to do the writing part. And then you might stay because you end up liking some others. But I do think, you know, that can only work with a VC-backed model because you're going to take a huge loss up front on that user. Like, the unit economics don't necessarily work at a $20 or $10, $20 a month price because you're paying these superstars to record this crazy stuff. But in the long run, if you get enough people seeing that as that edutainment category, it could really work. It could be, it seems like it's an incredible business, but I don't know the ins and outs of it. So, but I think the one thing nuance I'd add is though, like a MakerPad to me from the outside anyway, I see MakerPad or even like certain newsletters that I pay for, like trends.co from The Hustle. And I've had him and Alex Lieberman on as well from Morning Brew. And they both said something very similar, which is a paid product needs to have it's either going to make you money or it's going to make you smarter at your job or something like that. Or maybe it's going to save you time. Like, so for me, I pay for the Hustle's trends because I think they've got an army of analysts doing all this work all week, and then they get to share it with me in depth, and I pay like $20-$30 a month, whatever it is. And I think, okay, in terms of my time, that's great leverage for me just to have access to that information. But that's not for everyone, right? But they can afford to charge for that reason. So I'm curious, like, when you're thinking of communities, there's a difference between a free community and one that you can charge for. Like, similar to kind of like what they talked about with either saving you money, making you money, or better at your job, or saving you time. Is that like something you've thought about, like what qualifies as something that you can actually charge for in terms of community?
I don't know if I mean, I'd like to think that I thought about it more like cleverly than I did, but I think it was just like, I'm doing the work to figure out these tools and putting them together. Like, I'm spending the hours putting them together to try and make a fake Airbnb. Like, that's what you're paying for, basically, is like skipping the learning curve that I've just had to take. So I think it evolved from there of like that type of business. If it was just like the community needs to come around, like there needs to be a central point for the community. And it's either like the connection between each other. It's a, like an interest group or something. So with the ours, it was like this is the new thing to learn. Like, this actually would save you time at work. This would help make you smarter. You could actually use this practically. But the way I built MakePad in the first place was for people like myself, the ones that will just make it, like, take it upon themselves to go and learn the thing. Because if you go into MakePad, there's 333 tutorials I checked this morning. There's a lot there, and there's lots of tools, there's loads of like content. But if you're the type of person who needs someone to say, this is the tutorial you need, or this is a blog post you need, then it might just be overwhelming. You might think, oh, there's a lot here, I don't know where to start. And I get that, and we're trying to make that easier to navigate and things like that. But for me, it was like, if I landed on Airtable as a first user, I would never look at the tutorials or the guides or anything like that. I would just click it, start a new Airtable, click around, and then I learn stuff as I'm breaking stuff, essentially. I don't know. I think it's like, now I'm thinking of the wider scope of, if we're trying to reach, say, a million people and tell non-technical folks about what no-code is, what are the ways that we do that? Is it, do we spin up a bunch of courses? And we've got a cohort-based course launching in a couple of weeks where we're going to do like the fundamentals of no-code. Like, maybe that's something we can have as one of our pillar courses that we run four times a year or something. I think there's something in that. And I think we're just like, right now we get to explore those things. We get to explore what's going to actually work from an experience and like user model, as well as what makes a good business. And we don't have to like panic, or I don't have to panic so much as I did when MakePad was just like all on my shoulders. Like, we have a definite like push behind us now, and we've got the backing of Zapier. But to me, I still want to make sure that I want Zapier to feel like, oh, we could have paid 10 times what we did for MakePad, and it was still worth it, because this is like its own huge business and it's doing really, really well, and it's reaching hundreds of thousands of people. So I definitely want to do that. And it's just making me think more around like, what are the payment mechanics around it versus the user experience, and where do they clash and where do they make sense? And I think there's lots of like trends. Again, I think that's, I pay for trends as well. I don't use it that often, to be honest, but I know it's like for the people wanting to see inspiration, you see people building stuff around you. It's like, oh, that person actually took what Sam and Sean talked about in the last episode of the podcast, and they've built a project around it, and now they sold it. And it's like, oh, that sort of gives me motivation to do that thing myself. So that's an interesting community piece, I think. I don't know if I pay for any other community. Or Nest Labs from Anne Law, she does a like productivity hacks and how to like be more productive and things like that. I think, again, that's something that you can like quantify. You can see it in yourself. You can feel it, like, this has helped, or I'm feeling happier in myself and my work. So I think it's, yeah, with some of these things, you've got to really think of what are the outcomes you're aiming for and how does the model fit with that?
Yeah, completely, man. I think in our world, we're kind of used to seeing stuff being charged for because we're kind of earlier into like Substack and paid communities and what Anne's doing with Nest Labs and stuff. But I think for even with my background, I had a big like football website for a long time and I could probably never have charged like, you know, $100 a year. Just maybe I could have done a Patreon if it existed back then, which it didn't. But like I didn't really know what I was doing. So I just like had ads and affiliates and stuff like that. But like now I think I used to have like 500,000 people on the website and I did nothing with it really. You know, like I feel like I really messed up. But like today I'd be like, oh, well, cool. Maybe I could turn into a newsletter. I could do X, Y, Z. But I think even then, objectively speaking, I think there's a limit to how much I could charge for something like that in something that's just entertainment in that case. So I do think there's an element of what you said, like you guys are now going up that value chain and you're saying, okay, well, you've got a few $100 a year to be in MakerPad. But now there's a cohort based course, which I don't know the price, but I'm assuming it's in the thousands, right? Or like 500.
No, so it's, yeah, 900 is 900. Is course price for now. Yeah, yeah.
Got it. But, yeah.
I mean, it's like, yeah. So it's like you're saying, and it's not necessarily just like, oh, I could charge for this community or this thing. It's you're also competing against all the other communities, and there's so many more now, especially in these COVID times. That like, there's other places for people to meet. So it's like, okay, well, it's trying to get people's attention of like, okay, is this person spending 8 hours a week in the MakerPad community? Do we want them to be doing that? Or do we want them to just like find the thing that they need and then be able to go out often about their day? Like you're competing against those other communities, their job, their like social activities, like Netflix. There's all of these things that if you also bundle that in a subscription, it's like, okay, what are the things I actually pay for every month, every year? And what do I use in order of like my usage? Like Netflix and things like that are going to be up there. And then it's like, okay, maybe I didn't use Masterclass this month or things like that. So yeah, just it fascinates me all this stuff and figuring it all out.
Yeah, definitely, man. So let's move on a little bit from that. So I definitely think we're on the same page around you need to be providing enough value, whether that's saving someone's time, making them better at their job, to be able to charge for something. And I could see you guys going from, you know, like you said, creating specific courses for employees at big companies versus employees at startups. Like there's a very different use case, and maybe that fundamentals kind of track is like a pillar sort of thing that everyone could kind of gain from. But you know, specifically like at big companies, there's different problems you're solving. And so maybe there's something in that for you guys, but, I'm curious, like, as it comes to monetization, is that something you thought about from day one that you're going to charge for? Or is that just something that you kind of landed on eventually?
I had to charge for it because I had no job, I don't think. Like, it was from doing those, like, lots of side projects and thinking, okay, like, these things aren't working or nothing's quite working. Like, lots of the time I was just like, how am I going to do something full time? Like, how can I pay for my life? How can I do something? And I think you get stuck in that position a lot, and lots of people end up doing consulting and little gigs to get them from one side project to the next. And I did do my fair share of that. So before I even launched the first version of MakerPad, I had like a list of maybe like 800 people or so. And I sent everyone and said, oh, look, I'm doing tutorials on how to build things with no code, like an Airbnb clone. If you pay $50 through this type form, you'll get lifetime access to make like to this community. And 15 people without a landing page or anything, it was like 15 people I think paid for it then and there. And I was like, okay, well, nothing's gonna like light a fire under you more than people have paid you money. You've got to now deliver something for them. So yeah, I think it was just like from there, I was like, right, okay, I'm just always gonna charge. I never thought of not charging. So that's what we did. Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah, I love that, man, because you've kind of pre-promised something and then you kind of have to make it happen. Otherwise, you can just keep procrastinating and trying to figure out the perfect way to do it. Were there other categories that you considered beyond no code? Because I know you had like 50 other projects, but And maybe even if it wasn't stuff that you'd considered back then, are there others you see now that there's a huge need for, that like people are constantly coming to you and saying, oh, I'm trying to learn about X and I don't know where to go?
So I think no-code wasn't like the thing for me. It was just the thing that enabled me to do the things I was trying to do. So all the projects I was trying to launch, I was just building it without code, but the actual thing was often to do with like just startups generally. Like, I think one of them was trying to be like community managers as a service. Like a few years before community was then like the thing to talk about, it was like, we'll do your community for you, do the community management for you. But the way I built it was just like with a bunch of no-code tools, but the actual end game was anything to do with like startups or community. And I think I tried to go for a few jobs at like Stripe, which was like the startup role. I thought I really wanted to do like the platform role at a VC company. I thought, well, I'm sort of that in-between person. I'll help anyone figure out something. So if I was like on the platform side of things, founders could just ping me and say, oh, I'm trying to figure out this thing or this thing. And I would just try and find the right people to help there. And that's how I got started with Earnest Capital, actually. I was working with them and doing MakerPad on the side for like 9 months before we went full time and they funded us. So yeah, I don't know if there's anything specifically people ask me about. Everyone just talks about no code with me now, because I think I'm probably painting myself as that the no code guy. But
I think that's an interesting way that you described it there, though, because it wasn't like, oh, I'm so passionate about tools and no code. It's maybe you have an element of that too. It's more about you like startups, you like that scale of starting something from scratch, and this was something you saw that could help you get to that. So it was more like a means to an end versus like obsessively definitely about the tools, which I think some people are more in that other camp.
Yeah, and I think like that's definitely come with time. And I'm like, okay, I love these set of tools that I use all the time, and I feel like I can build almost anything with them. I think that was the point. But I was just very much interested in like, how do you build a business? And like different funding models, indie hackers, all of these things. It's like, oh, these are different people building businesses, and what are the different ways that people can build businesses? And I think I was always in that camp. And I think I'm still around there, where I think I'm decent or okay at the starting of things. Because like I said about the headless chicken stuff, like doing lots of different things at one time, I think that's where I've sort of been for a long time. I don't know that I'm like the scaler, where I can see something that works and then turn it into a repeatable model that works really well and scales really well. So for me, having like Zapier come and acquire us, me getting to chat with Wade and seeing, well, this is someone who's actually done all of those different stages of starting something, scaling something, and now it's getting even bigger. So could I have someone in my corner to like coach me through those things? Like maybe I do start transitioning from the scrappy like startup person to more of a, I know how to run a business now.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting point you just brought up there, because you're kind of referencing the different stages of like an entrepreneur or a business person, I guess. And I don't know if you're referencing specifically this, but like Andrew Wilkinson, who's on the show, talked about the four types, right? And he talks about like the Chipotle example, the person who comes up with a burrito, the person who turns it into Chipotle, the person who scales to a bunch of different regions or whatever. And then there's the last one, which is just like the kind of manager, essentially. There's probably another word for it, like an operator. And I think I've heard you actually mention this, that you had the humility to say, maybe I'm just that first one. And I think that's actually really great for most people, because most people aren't all four of those. Well, actually, I don't think almost anyone is. Maybe like Mark Zuckerberg, maybe Wade from Zapier is close, but like, I'd say like going from dude in a Harvard room to like one of the biggest companies in the world. Yeah, clearly has done that. But even for Mark Zuckerberg, he had Sheryl Sandberg to come in, who is probably that number two, three, and four. So I'm curious for you, like, how are you thinking about that? Is that something you say, well, I want to grow as a business leader and as an entrepreneur and do those other stages? because like that's something I want to grow as? Or is it just saying, well, no, I'm actually really good at the first two parts and maybe I'll take Maker Pad to a certain size and then maybe you'll move on to something else? Is that something you've kind of thought about?
Yeah, so I don't know, because I think I'm still in that early camp. I don't know whether I can do the other pieces. But yeah, that was the episode I was referencing, actually, was that. And I think I said it publicly because I think it's important for people to think about it themselves. I think, am I kidding myself? Am I like faking it to other people as well? Because as I have a fund now that invests in other companies, I'm like, what are the chances that you invest in one company or one founder, including when people did that with me, that they're really good at the starting piece, and then they're really good at the scaling piece, and then they're really good at the operating piece, all the way to like a public company, like thinking that way through. That's just a crazy different level of skills in like those different stages. And there are definitely people out there who do that. But I was like, for me in my life at this stage, I'm 30 years old. Am I like, I've only started one company really, like that's MakerPad, and it was acquired in 18 months. Like, am I just still the starter? I have no idea, but I'd love to know how to, or feel confident in that. Oh, I know how, like a company that has some revenue, have some pieces moving. Can I identify what needs to be scaled here and like look at running a company? I might find that in 5 years' time, running a company, I'm like, okay, I'm okay at this, but it's not what I love doing. I love like the starting pieces. But I think being an investor, you get to see a lot of that stuff with a lot less of the stress of actually starting those companies.
Yeah.
So I think hopefully that will scratch my itch of the starting piece anyway, because I've got no desire to like start another thing myself in any sort of capacity anytime soon. I do just really want to learn how to like recognize something that works and then say, right, okay, I'm going to turn this into a business that like runs really well. I think I want that, to learn that piece, my next, like put that on the CV kind of type stage. Thing where I can run a business. Yeah.
Yeah. But well, I think it's really cool to hear, to be honest, because a lot of people, I think it just comes down to like the self-awareness to know like what you want at that current stage. And maybe in 5 years, I know you're getting married soon, you might have kids, and you might want to do like the passive investing thing and you chill on your yacht, right? But like you finally go and get a yacht. Yeah. But I think what's cool is, you know, as an entrepreneur anyway, you kind of, especially having a win under your belt, you now have the ability to have that choice to a certain extent. And it's just, I'm thinking of people I've had on the show where, like, for example, Sampa from The Hustle, like, he hasn't said anything to me personally that makes me think this, but just like interacting with him and speaking to him a bit, like, to me, he's like a purebred entrepreneur. Like, he loves starting stuff. He's like the early stage guy. I can't imagine him being at HubSpot in 5 years' time, and I could be wrong, but I just feel like he's probably fine with it for now, but I just feel like he's the sort of person who's just so like early stage that I can imagine him either, I don't know if he'll actually start something again, but I just feel like that's his natural way of being. But I think for you to hear you say, oh, actually, like, I want to grow in this role. And actually, sorry, I'm kind of boxing him in. Like, he might also want to do the same thing. And probably he's doing that right now with HubSpot. But it just feels like for you specifically, you're seeing it more like a growth, a place where you can just grow into that next stage. And then I guess you'll see how it goes from there.
Yeah, I think Sam, he probably was a fair few levels above me anyway in terms of running an actual company and doing that well. And I think he, like, to me, him and Sean seem like schemers, where the podcast is their outlet for that. They have like talk about ideas all the time, how to do this, how you would think about that. But I don't know if I see it in any, I think I can see it in them that they're like, oh yeah, we talk about this, I actually don't want to go and do it. Like, I'm not ready to go. I don't want to go and do any of that stuff. Someone else can do that. Cause I think we're all sort of similar ages that it's like, okay, we're all actually in a very similar stage where we've all launched something. It's all of them have been acquired. I think Sean's a bit older than me. I don't know if Sam's around the same age. I think like it's a very funny, Austin from Morning Brew, similar. Every one of those are like investing at some point as well. It's like a weird little group of people doing the same sort of thing. And I don't know that like people, like us would necessarily run to start something again. But yeah, for me, I'd love to, because people ask me about like how to run a business and stuff. And I'm like, I'm not sure. I'm still figuring it out. Yeah. So I would just love to like know that and have that skill set of like, I know I can start something and run something. Like that would be way more valuable to me than just be like, I'm a business starter. And I think those things, yeah. Where those goalposts are different for different people. Like I ran a company, I guess, for 2 years, but like running a company up to like 10 million a year would be a very different type of experience. So I'd love to like look at that as, could I get there?
No, I completely get it. Yeah, and I think you made a great point there on Sam specifically that, yeah, he's been doing the hustle for quite some time. Like if you got quite 18 months, maybe his was 5-6 years. I've forgotten the time. And they grew to like tens of millions of dollars or something like that, I believe. So, yeah, completely. And I think all of you guys are in a position where like I don't think you just want to retire. That's kind of my point, right? Right. No one's trying to just be like, oh, I sold something, I want to chill now. And maybe you want to chill in your own way, but it's like you find this interesting. You're not doing it necessarily just to buy a yacht. You're doing it because you find it like interesting. And I see the same in Sean, because like when I've spoken to Sean, he's told me like his next stage, whenever that is going to be like him and like one or two people, kind of like the stuff he's already started doing, the kind of that individual creator style. And I think even for someone like me, I've seen that as the most attractive path in recent times, because you just get the full autonomy, you get to scheme in that part, but then you also can, nowadays with a team and like these tools, you can scale pretty quickly. So I think it's just a really unique time for smart people to work on stuff like this.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's really exciting.
Yeah, man. So real quickly on MakerPad. So we talked a lot about like starting it, but let's talk about the growth. So if I was saying the 80-20 of growth, so the 20% of work or inputs that drove 80% of the results, and maybe it's not exactly that split, but just, you know, the most, the stuff that if you were ranking in order of the most important stuff to grow MakerPad, like what would you put in that bucket?
We basically didn't do anything. Like, we didn't do any marketing or anything like that. So again, probably something I'll learn as like learning to run a business is then you need to rely on some growth things and figure them out. But for us, it was just put out good content and then share it on Twitter and our email list. And that was just how we grew. I think the space, like timing and the space obviously helped with a lot of that stuff. And like I was making sure that the tools knew us and we knew the tools and we were chatting to them and using them to do partnerships and produce content with them and do stuff like that. So I think it all like, it helped to be the first for us, and it helped to be like that central hub of the no code community. And I think it was just, we've built a brand that is synonymous with the word no code. And I think that obviously doesn't happen overnight, but it wasn't like a thing on my whiteboard to say, right, we've got to be this, we've got to be this, let's get there. It was just, let's put out really good content and let's like just share it on Twitter, which is where we hang out. And like, I would like to think the rest will take care of itself. And I think there's obviously things you could have done more of and less of, but I think one of the people Cortland interviewed, Vincent from CodaPad, he, like, his philosophy of running businesses was just, like, very straight and very blunt. And he was just like, well, we just did stuff and never looked at analytics or anything like that. And I kind of wanted to be a bit like that of, I don't obsess about, is engagement going up every week? Is it, like, is this happening every week? Is this happening every week? Because I think there's enough going on trying to start a company that is working than also worrying about every single number you possibly can. And I don't know, that's probably not the right way to think about it. But for me, it was like, that's what we have to do to be able to focus on, let's do really good content. And then actually building up like the biggest library of no code content on the internet is now like probably way more of a moat than it would have been if I was trying to do some of the other little things and getting smaller wins. But yeah, time will tell what growth should actually happen and how that should actually work. But
Well, you're definitely in a place to be able to learn that from someone who's done it before. So I think you'll be figuring a lot of that out soon. A quick question on that. So it sounds like you never did like any paid acquisition or anything like that, right? You've never spent money on ads or anything. Yeah, I mean, I feel like just given how specific your vertical is and like the type of person, and you've already got this like basically seed list of, you know, signals of people who like your stuff, like I'm pretty sure paid acquisition could like work really, really well as well, just because you've already got something that's working. Whereas in the beginning, you're starting, you're figuring out, do people actually need this? But at this stage, I think you're probably at the stage where, you know, some of those platforms like Facebook and stuff like that could actually work pretty efficiently. But just another point, part of this, you said we just created content and put it out. So obviously that's a team. Like hiring good people is a big part of what you did. And you found people like Tom Osman, our mutual friend, and others who have been like creating great stuff. So I'm curious, like how, what was the best way to find those people for you? Was it just people from your community, or was there another approach you took?
Yeah. So for Tom specifically, he's no longer with me, Paddy's like, he's doing the creative thing himself now. So he obviously like advertised within the community and said, does anyone want to like come on and help me do content? Basically it's like me research how to do something without code and I'll do the tutorial. So Tom, like one of his application was like, oh, this is how I do this. And I said, oh, cool. Can you do like a Loom and show me how you did that? And he didn't. And I was like, cool, that's a tutorial. Like, you've done it. Now you can just make tutorials. So I sort of tricked him.
He started the job, basically.
Yeah, and I was like, great, that's a tutorial. And that can go straight on the site. Like, that's how you should film a tutorial, is you're explaining it to someone you know that's like, oh, this is how you do this, and then you do this. He then started producing content for the site. Same happened with Amy, who is still with us and is our head of content. She just like, I was like, oh, just do a video like you would explain it to me or Tom. And then I think it was just like, okay, got you. You're now a tutorial person. And now we've done more and more of that. So yeah, we've done lots of content and it's all credit to them for producing all of that. And now we have this Creators in Residence program where there's so many people in no code who are trying to build up their own brand, trying to maybe have their own newsletter, their own community or whatever it is. And I think, like, they want to get their name out there. I want MakerPad to be a platform for people like that. Well, we'll pay them to do blog content, or we'll pay them to do tutorial content, like Tessa's doing with us. There's Sarah, who's done a bunch of stuff with us. So it's like giving them an opportunity to go and be a creator and do this whole creator stuff, not being tied down to a full-time job, but also can rely on paychecks from MakerPad to do content. I think it's like a situation where I would have taken that opportunity if I'd had it like at the end of my time at Product Hunt. I think that's what like I would have wanted for myself, is there's a program we can sort of do a couple of things here.
That's cool, man. What about like, as you're the person who's starting it, there's a point where you transition from just being you and other people, and you kind of, even when you have people in the beginning, sometimes you're still really working in the business, not on the business. Like you're the one creating all the tutorials, you're the one sending invoices to your partners and whatever. And there's like a transition point that's normally kind of a mental thing where you have to say, okay, I'm doing stuff I shouldn't be doing. And it normally comes from the fact that you normally can do it better than someone else. Like, and over time, you might find people who do it better than you. But in the beginning, it takes a bit of time to train people up. So I'm curious, like, when was that moment for you? And was there anything that helped you kind of move through that moment?
Yeah, so I've always struggled with like the maker versus manager mindset. And I don't know. I still don't know which one I'm in. Like, I still do all the support. I still do all the invoices. I still do all that stuff. And it's not because I'm like, oh, I can do it best. Like, I definitely can't do support the best, but it just doesn't seem like a huge thing for us to offload somewhere else. We got to a point where we were like 10 people, like part-time contract mixture of people, because we were trying to do so many different things. But now we're trimmed back, because it was like, well, we're doing, there's too many plates spinning here. Like, what are we doing? Who is our customer? What are we trying to provide for them? Are we just having too many things at too many times? So we've gone through like multiple times of that. And I think it's like my default state is like, okay, I'll go and build something. So I'll build like features on the site. So I'll build like a profile system. I'll build this, I'll build that. And that's my default, because that's what I like I really liked doing is creating something like that. And then I'm like, well, that was probably 2 months. I didn't need to be doing that stuff because we didn't check it with anyone. We didn't interview people about, do they want that? It wasn't like the whole, what you'd usually do to see if a feature is worth building. It was more of a, if I can, I will. So I'm still struggling with that. I'm still figuring out, am I in the business or on the business? And how do I need to split my time? And how should that, like, I need that to be intentional. So I'm still, yeah, I'm still working on that. I'm still doing the support. But I think with, like, our focus at the moment of having, like, this cohort-based course, I know that I'll be teaching in the course. And at the moment, I'm still, like, helping to push out the course and, like, how that's going to work. But I know that I'd love to just know, this is our format. This is how we teach it. Ben, you come in and teach for this session, and you teach for this session. So I'm trying to really get some, like, processes and stuff in place for that. But yeah, it's just a learning curve and having people to figure it out.
Yeah, for sure, man. Well, the last question on that is, if you were starting again from 2021, because this was only 18, 24 months, I guess. So if you were starting this from scratch again today, is there anything you'd do differently knowing what you know now?
I have no idea. I probably would. But I don't even know what yet. I think it's just, it's probably having that focus of do less things, but just do them better. Like, you don't have to do everything. I think that's my, yeah. I think it's the same with no code of, if you think up something and you know how to use like four tools really well, you automatically think, how do I use all those four tools together to do this thing? Whereas there might be one tool that does that as well as you need it to anyway. But don't over engineer stuff just for the sake of it. Just think of the simplest version, I think.
Completely, man. Well, listen, man, thanks for sharing all of that on MakerPad. The last part I wanted to just ask you a little bit about before we wrap up is no code in general. So you're one of the best people to ask these questions to because you're seeing so much and all the different tools out there and makers from all angles. And even now on the investing side with your rolling fund as well. So I'm curious, like, and this was a question from the audience as well. I've heard you mention that in the future, you hope that no code isn't a thing in 5 years, like the phrase no code. Like, could you just elaborate on that first of all? Like, what do you mean by that?
Well, I just hope it's so ingrained in like the process, like the process of learning to build something, that you're not thinking, are you taking this route or this route? I think I've said the same analogy where if my mum was going to look how to build a website, she wouldn't type how to build a website with no code, and she wouldn't type how to build a website with code. But if she typed in how to build a website, she should be seeing, this is how you do it with card with zero code. This is how you do it with Webflow, a bit more technical. This is how you do it with HTML, CSS, like pick your path type thing. So, I mean, MakerPad, we want to be that jumping off point for people. So I think
I like that. That's a great example. And so if you were looking in like 5 to 10 years, just seeing what you're seeing, where the growth of different tools are going and stuff in the no-code space, what do you think that world kind of looks like in 5 to 10 years from now?
I don't know. That's tough. I think there's going to be a lot more. I can't tell, actually, if it's going to be no-code is a skill set that lots of professionals have across the organization, like marketing ops, sales ops, customer support ops, and whether there's like a broad range of people who have those skills, or whether it's like a dedicated person within a company that is like, this is the no code person that builds all these systems and does that. But I think we'll just see a lot of these things brought into the workplace. And I think it has to be for it to go mainstream. And I think it has to be to sort of break down that, like the whole, at the moment, I think it's just stuck in the tech Twitter, indie hacker, like maker communities, which is fine. Like things need to be fostered there, but I think there's a danger of no code could become like drop shipping, where it's like, oh, drop shippers are building courses for drop shippers, and then it's more like drop shipping stuff, and we don't want that to happen. The point of no code is that like anyone can do this, and like anyone can pick up something, and it's a lot easier to learn, and it's all of these things. So we need to be intentional about how we're doing that. And I think that's lots of things that I'm thinking about is, if that's the way we see the future, we've got to make sure that we're like willing that into existence and making steps towards that.
Yeah, I like the way you described it there as like, it's not about which tool you're using. It's like, oh, I want to create a website. I want to create a marketplace. I want to create an app. And if you're able to show someone a quicker and easier way to do like the first version of that, that makes a lot of sense. But I agree, it's kind of a hard thing because the phrase no code has helped popularize a lot of these tools and get it to more people. But then in a similar way, it's almost limiting it by using the jargon and stuff like that. So yeah, I think there's parallels in other kind of emerging tech where when you kind of get in that little world, the example I'm thinking of is crypto to a certain extent. Like also in 10 years time, if we're all using the word crypto, that would be a bit weird to me because hopefully by then just like digital money is normal and it's part of like you pull out your wallet on your phone or you know, like it doesn't necessarily have to be Bitcoin, but I just think there's so much jargon in that world that it just confuses the hell out of people. And for a regular person, they don't need to know what smart contracts are and all that stuff. In the same way, they don't know when I send you an ACH payment bank transfer, most people don't know what actually happens with the clearing of the funds and going from NatWest Bank to Halifax or whatever. So I think we'll get closer to that when we simplify things. Thanks for your answer on that. The last couple of things I want to ask about were just about learning no code. So if someone is new to this space, obviously they should go and check out MakerPad to go through a lot of your learning tracks, and you've got this new course as well. But again, if you were trying to say you're trying to maximize the time spent, right, because there's unlimited things you can kind of learn, is there like a learning track you recommend that people should potentially start on, or is it so dependent on what they're trying to get to in whatever they're trying to create?
I think it can depend, but I think what we're doing with the course is like we're running people through, here's like six projects you're going to build, because once you can build those, you can basically build anything. And there's tools for everything. There's so many different types of tools, and you can spend all day just debating which is the right one for you. I think it's just pick Card, CARD.co, build a website, and then it could take you 20 minutes. It could take you 20 days. Like that's up to the person. But I think it's just seeing what can be done by visually picking things up and dragging them around. And I think that's the easiest, quickest place to start is something like that.
If you don't mind sharing, what are those six types of projects? Like even a couple of them.
Yeah, so it's how to build a one-page website. It's memberships, like how to build a membership site like MakerPad, a marketplace, a job board, how to like selling online, digital or physical goods, automations. But with those, because it's like you can build things with one tool in that. So the one page website is like, this is just one tool you need to use and you can get that thing done. But then if you want to build a membership site, you'll see there's lots of different components that you could have. Zapier talk to MemberStack, you could have Circle here, you could have this tool here, this tool. But the point of the whole course is like, there are a million ways, and the same with MakerPad is, there are a million ways to do this exact same thing. And people often use our tutorials as not just like a step-by-step reference, it's just a point of reference to see, oh, this is, I can build a membership site with some of these tools, and this is how they're connected. But actually, I don't use Webflow, I use Squarespace, so I'm going to swap them out. And the point is, most of these things can be swapped out for those other pieces that you like. It's about finding the tools that work for you. So,
and learning the skills to be able to figure it out as well yourself.
It's just recognizing the patterns of what brings software together. And then through those projects that we teach, if I look at a marketplace, I recognize that there's a form there, and that just goes to something in the back end, which will be our database. So that would be like an Airtable for me. There's a payment here. That could be a Stripe link. Again, that will go to a database. And you just start recognizing those Lego blocks of what makes up like most of the products on the internet, basically.
Yeah, completely. Well, listen, man, you've gone through so much detail. The last question I have for you today is about the ecosystem and what's missing. Again, you're investing in companies in this space. So I'm curious, like, what are you looking for and what's attracting your attention? Because, there's, like you said, there's like unlimited tools by this point. But there's probably unlimited opportunities as well to improve things too. So yeah, I'm curious, like what is missing from your point of view?
Yeah, I mean, I said this before somewhere where I was like, if I knew that, I probably would have built it. Like, I honestly haven't got a clue. Like, what is actually missing? It's like, it's just, what are ways that we can reach more people? What's one of those killer tools that means my mum ends up touching no code? Like, what are those things? And I think lots of the places we're investing is in, yeah, at the workplace. Like, how do you get no code in the workplace? How do you have automation systems for marketing that like empower the marketing team? How do you do customer support in a more automated way? All of the internal tooling platforms, those sorts of things. So there's lots of stuff there that we're like, that's what I think the biggest impact is. So I think that'll be an interesting space to look at.
Yeah. How's that been for you actually being on the other side with the investing? Has that been has it been quite a steep learning curve or has it been pretty straightforward?
I mean, yes, I feel like it's straightforward. I don't know if I'm the best investor or the worst investor. I guess we'll find out in like 10 years.
But 10-year time.
I try and just, yeah, again, I just try and be upfront and say, look, I'm not pretending to be the biggest check on your cap table. I'll probably be one of the smallest, but I'm here to help with anything to do with no code and community. And that's like, I'll stay in my lane there. And we just want to make sure that we're backing all the people who are building this space. No code, low code, developer tools, internal tools, all of that stuff. I think, like I said, it's not like a straight line of this is no code and this isn't. There's lots of things where it touches. So we're just trying to make sure that we're seeing all the best deals and reaching the best people.
That's amazing, man. Well, listen, dude, I really appreciate you taking so much time today. And
yeah,
it's really cool to hear like the growth, and it's really cool to see you growing too, man, like from being in China to doing 50 projects and Product Hunt to selling, and now hopefully like the next decade is you growing as an entrepreneur and person. So
yeah,
really happy for you, man, and hopefully we can do this again in the future.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, really appreciate that.
All right, cheers, mate. We'll speak to you soon.
Cheers. Bye.
Hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can also watch all of these visually, plus bonus clips on youtube.com/creatorlabfm. I'll have an episode for you every week. These are raw, uncut, and actionable conversations with the greatest business minds and creators in the world. So make sure you're subscribed. If you enjoyed the show, let me know what you think. You can say hello to me on Twitter. I'm at BZaidie, BZAIDI, or CreatorLabFM on any other channel. I really appreciate it. It helps spreading the word with your friends and colleagues. It helps to get this out to more people and allows me to get better guests for you guys. And lastly, if you want access to exclusive content and free giveaways like the recent books that we gave out, make sure you're subscribed to the email list. I'll send out an occasional email with lessons learned from the episode. So if you're interested in that, and of course the free giveaways, who doesn't like those, go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. Until then, I'll see you on Twitter and speak to you next week.